The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia and the Amelia Gordon Memorial Lecture, which Toby and I established along with others to honor Toby's mother. Amelia Gordon taught business skills to children with physical and mental disabilities at the Widener School, and she pursued a lifelong learning, bringing her daughters and her grandchildren and friends to share her love of the Free Library. This author event series is really only possible through the support of caring individuals like you and others. So please consider making a gift to the Free Library to enable the continuation of these programs and also the hundreds of other programs that take place at the 53 library branches throughout the city. I'm excited tonight to introduce M. Chris Fabricant, one of the foremost experts on forensic science and the criminal justice system in the U.S. Chris is the Director of Strategic Litigation at an nonprofit organization called the Innocence Project. It's a group that focuses on using now DNA and scientific advancements to obtain the release of wrongfully convicted individuals. He's a former public defender and law professor, and he frequently served as a public speaker on law reform and justice, and has published numerous articles in leading law journals. In his new book, which you'll hear about tonight, Junk Science and the American Criminal Justice System, he demonstrates how evidence and testimony from self-proclaimed forensic experts providing what is commonly referred to as junk science has led to the wrongful conviction of many innocent people and contributes to our unjust and racist criminal justice system. Chilling details are found in the book of examples of supposed experts in everything from bite marks to shoe prints you relied upon to convict what turns out later to be innocent individuals. Chris will be in conversation with John Holloway, the Associate Dean and Executive Director of the Quattron Center for Fair Administration of Justice at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. John is also an author, having written a wonderful book called Killing Time, about an 18-year journey to free a wrongfully convicted death row inmate. Before we begin, please make sure that you've silenced your cell phones, no flash photography, and please keep your masks on, which I will in a moment, throughout the program. Following the discussion here, there'll be a book signing upstairs. And don't forget that most of these lectures are available as podcasts on the library's website, freelibrary.org, and videos of them also on youtube.com/author events. Please join me in welcoming Chris Fabricant and John Holloway to the Free Library.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming out. I wasn't always going to do readings at these events, but I decided to because I think if you looked at the book or you thought about what the subject matter is, that you might get a dry text or something very science-oriented, and really what I've tried to do is write a more of a personal book that explores some of these stories and some of the work that I've done. And so what I'm going to read is a chapter, or a very short, five-minute part of a chapter when surrounding the first Innocence client that I met after starting at the Innocence Project in 2012. Interstate 45 originates in the southeast corner of Texas near the Killing Fields, a 25-acre patch of dirt outside of League City where the bodies of at least 30 victims, nearly all young women thought to have been murdered by multiple serial killers, have been found since the 1970s. The highway runs a straight line north from League City through Houston before petering out in Dallas. The featureless terrain is so flat, I could almost see Huntsville 65 miles away from my rental car as I headed north out of the Houston airport. An hour later, I passed the 70-foot-tall statue of Sam Houston on the outskirts of Huntsville. A white school bus with wrought iron mesh covering darkened windows passed in the southbound lane. the Texas Department of Criminal Justice's sky blue steel stamped on its side. Prisoners on the chain, handcuffed to each other for grinding cross-state bus rides on steel benches, heading from one cage to another. 58,000 prisoners endure roughly 22,000 trips or bus therapy across Texas every year, covering close to 5 million miles. Forgotten people going to hidden places. I pulled into the visitor's parking lot and stuck the file on the passenger seat into my shoulder bag. The inch-thick stack of paper represented everything I knew about Cheney's case. There were some pages of transcripts, Jim Hale's and Homer Campbell's testimony, a copy of the appellate opinion, crime scene photos of the Sweeks' mutilated bodies, and dozens of photos of the U-shaped injury on John Sweeks' forearm. Julie Lesser met me under the three-story red brick guard tower at the front gate. Razor wire gates parted as we walked along a sidewalk cutting through a neatly trimmed lawn to the main entrance. At the guardhouse, a corrections officer scrutinized my New York State bar card before allowing me to sign in for a legal visit. Heavy steel doors slid closed behind us with a thousand-year thud as Lesser and I walked the gray corridor toward a row of cubicles partitioned down the middle by thick plexiglass. Black phones were mounted on the right-hand sides of the walls. There, in the center booth, sat my first Innocence Project client. He'd been waiting a long time. During my time as a public defender in the South Bronx, I spent a lot of time visiting clients on Rikers Island, New York City's infamous jail island complex in the East River. My clients were mostly young men bursting with rage, fear, desperation, and yes, hope. In my earlier work as an appellate defender, my clients had already been convicted at trial and were just beginning to serve lengthy prison sentences, slowly emptied of hot emotions, nurturing hope for freedom in prison law libraries in upstate New York. Most of my clients, those thrumming with pent-up energy on Rikers and those warehoused in century-old upstate prisons, were deeply skeptical of public defenders. Trust was earned only through showing respect and fighting hard. Usually I lost. Often I would not see or hear from my clients again after a conviction. There was always another, more immediate crisis, another trial, another appeal, another arraignment shift. The wheel never stopped turning. There were thousands of individual people I represented, sometimes for a few minutes at arraignments, sometimes for a few years, but I'd never visit anyone 25 years into a life sentence. My file also held Stephen Cheney's arrest photo, a color Polaroid from the day Detective Westfall pulled him off the construction site in Las Colinas. Deeply tanned from laboring under the Texas sun, Cheney wore a dusty white t-shirt that hugged his wiry frame, his chin pointed at the camera defiantly, exposing a prominent Adam's apple. His robust head of dirty blonde hair framed intense blue eyes. The coiled energy radiating from the photo is pure Rikers Island. That was not the man sitting on the opposite side of the grimy plexiglass. Cheney had been drained of color. His eyes and his hair had gone iron gray. Deep lines ran like rivers across his pale forehead and down the sides of his mouth. His dull white prison scrubs made him nearly invisible. Only the black, prison-issued Buddy Holly-style glasses stood out. I sat down on the steel stool in front of Cheney and picked up the phone. As he lifted his phone, Cheney bowed his head, seemingly collecting himself. When he looked back up, tears were streaming from his eyes and rushing through the lines the wind unit had carved into his face. "See," Lesser said to Cheney. "I told you he would come." None of the years I'd spent as a public defender prepared me for this. I'd never walked into a client interview and been treated like a savior, like I was wearing a cape. For the deeply religious Cheney, Julie Lesser was the vehicle Jesus had sent him, and our meeting in Huntsville was further evidence of the greatness of God. Cheney had spent the last decade watching Innocence Project lawyers free his fellow prisoners. Here was his own. In that moment, I felt an awesome responsibility. Cheney had just been a test case for me until then, an ideal vehicle for using the junk science writ to challenge the status quo. I did not think about whether he was guilty or innocent. It was simply a perfect case. But now I had a client. A client who believed I could make prison doors open with a wave of a wand. It was terrifying. There was little I could tell Cheney about bite mark evidence that he didn't already know. At his elbow was a battered copy of Scientific Evidence, a comprehensive treatise on forensics edited by some of the most respected science and law scholars in the country. Cheney knew it better than I did. He knew about footwear evidence, presumptive blood tests, and polygraphs, the throw-in junk science used against him. Cheney knew subtle lies and liars. He knew waiting in line, but unlike me, he knew he was innocent, and unlike me, he had faith. I tried to temper expectations. There were a lot of bad facts and no more DNA to test, but Cheney never stopped smiling during the hour or so we spent together. He knew our meeting was a manifestation of his faith. God bless you, Mr. Fabricant. I wasn't sure what to say. We pressed our hands together through the glass, and I flew back to New York.
So welcome, everybody. I'm John Hallway. I am an associate dean at Penn Law, as Mark said with that lovely introduction. I work at a center called the Quattrone Center for the Fair Administration of Justice. And we try to learn from cases like the ones that Chris represents and do research and data on them to help prevent the next one. So without Chris's work, we would have no center. For those of you who have read the book, you know already what that fantastic reading will show those of you who haven't, which is Junk Science is a really remarkable book in its storytelling and its mixture of both the really powerful anecdotes of the wrongfully convicted that Chris makes his living rectifying, but also then taking a step back and being very educational about the myriad challenges in forensic science, where of all places we think we're supposed to be certain, and really revealing just how far from that promise we are. Let me kind of set the stage by asking how many people in the room here are attorneys? Okay. And how many of you are criminal law attorneys? Okay, smaller number. Okay, so that, now we can level set.
Okay.
What I have to say one piece of bragging that Chris knew I was going to do, which is that Chris and I actually go back to the previous century where we went to George Washington together, and I was Chris's legal research and writing instructor when I was a third year and he was a first year. So I really set him off on his path. And without me, you know, without the Innocence Project, there's no Quattrone Center, but without John Hallway.
Right here, where would I be?
You know, exactly. But it's a real pleasure to have to be back with you here tonight. And you know, when you're telling stories, you have to make choices, right? So talk to us about why Junk Science as a book and why bite marks as an area of junk science for your focus.
You know, junk science, one I should say, is that I was a public defender for a long time. I wasn't an expert in science before I got to the Innocence Project. I was an English major when I was in college, and I spent about a year when I got to the Innocence Project learning about science. And what happened, and people like Jules Epstein, who I think is there, was one of my mentors during that period, and met with and some of the leading scientists in the country that were interested about in advancing justice. And my role was to start a new legal department called Strategic Litigation, and what we were going to do is challenge the leading contributing factors to wrongful conviction. So this is eyewitness misidentification is the leading, but right behind that is junk science, you know, the misapplication of forensic sciences in criminal trials. And so my role was going to be, and is, apart from running this department, was going to be litigation around forensic sciences and trying to both free the innocent that had been convicted on junk science, and many of the cases that I talk about in the book are non-DNA exonerations. And what that means is that they didn't have definitive evidence showing that, you know, not only was this person not guilty, but identifying the actual perpetrator, although one of the cases I talk about, that's true. And the other problem with that, though, of course, is that how are we going to demonstrate innocence when it's simply a junk science conviction? And so what my role and the other lawyers in my department is to identify these cases and the worst offenders of the various techniques that have been used in known wrongful conviction cases. So we looked at all the different techniques in many, many, including DNA, including fingerprints, and some of the more reliable techniques that we're all familiar with have been used and led to wrongful convictions, used improperly and led to wrongful convictions. Bite marks, however, is something that can never be used appropriately. And there's no there with bite marks, and it would be, you know, purely junk science. It was the lowest hanging fruit of, you know, this the various techniques that have been used in wrongful conviction. And as we sit here today, there is at least 35 known wrongful convictions and indictments based on, at least in part, on bite mark evidence, which is an astonishing figure if you think about how really unusual it is to use bite mark evidence. So, you know, when we talk about what junk science means, I want to be careful about what we say, because it's a pejorative. You know, people that, you know, certainly forensic practitioners hate that word, and it doesn't apply to all forensics, be clear about that. But what I mean by that is that it's subjective speculation masquerading as scientific evidence. There's no scientific validation research that underlines the claims that are being made in court. And they sound like science, and they're very impressive, and they're usually introduced by an expert witness, somebody that is deemed an expert in court in front of a jury. And it's very, very powerful because jurors, like everybody else, they want to know what happened, right? They're trying to figure it out. They're trying to do the right thing. And when you can point to scientific evidence as an objective fact from an expert that doesn't have a stake in the outcome of the case, that doesn't have, isn't biased against anybody in particular, is just doing science, then that's a fact. It's a truth that the jurors can claim that they are not going to be able to divine for themselves. And so we've seen this in so many, because half of a DNA exonerations involve the use of junk science, is that as how powerful that is. And some of the stories, including one of the main stories in Stephen Cheney's case, you see that I mentioned a couple of the other techniques that were used in his case that led to his wrongful conviction, including polygraph evidence and presumptive blood tests, but it was really the bite marks. And he had 9 alibi witnesses, 9. That accounted for every second of his day, of the day that this horrendous double homicide that had been convicted or had been perpetrated. And all these witnesses were unimpeached. One of them ultimately became his wife and stood by his side for 30 years that he spent in prison. And junk science was enough to overcome all of that. Stephen Cheney had no prior record. He had had 2 marijuana arrests in his entire life. He was a union iron worker. And the power of junk science was enough to put him away for nearly his entire adult life.
So when you say that there's not a lot of scientific underpinnings for bite marks, I'd like to break that down a little bit. Do we know if people's teeth patterns are unique?
No. That's kind of a red herring, too, because if you think about uniqueness, and uniqueness comes up in forensics all the time, is, in fingerprints and in bite marks and shoe prints even, if you get a randomly acquired characteristic on the bottom of your shoes, sometimes people think that's unique. And it's often less the issue on uniqueness, right? Because teeth probably are unique. If you look at them closely enough, if you look at anything closely enough, it's probably going to be, at least highly distinct. But the issue is really how much information can you gather from an actual bite mark, right? And it's not enough to identify the particular teeth that made a bite mark. Skin doesn't record it. It's not a piece of clay or putty or something like that.
Oh, hold on a minute. Did you just say that skin doesn't record a bite mark?
Yeah, that's a problem with this.
So when I've got a bite mark on my hand and I want to match it to your teeth, you're saying the skin's not a reliable substrate.
Right. So
I'm shocked by this news.
Yeah, well, you'd be not the first person, but it's funny too is that so many of these techniques, if you think about them critically, should have been eliminated a long time ago, right? Because if you think about bite marks for just another example, is that these images are usually captured days after either a homicide or an assault, right? The injury has changed quite a bit over that time. In a homicide, the body has been decomposing and will change the way it looks. In a living victim, it'll be healing, it'll be swelling, it'll change, right? So you might match one day and might not match the next day, right? And there's no accounting for that. There's no way to predict how that skin would change. Nobody ever asked that. I've read thousands of cross-examinations. Nobody was ever cross-examined on that because it makes, like a lot of junk science, intuitive sense, right? If you don't, you're just trying to figure out what happened. You want to tell the story. You're connecting dots that may or may not should be connected. And this type of evidence is used to bridge that gap. And just to go back to the uniqueness thing for 1 minute, because I think it's an important concept to explore a little bit just in terms of the other techniques that we're talking about. Because you've heard fingerprints maybe once or twice already, and probably like a lot of you, I too believe that fingerprints are probably unique. That's not a scientifically validated fact. But more the issue, and this is always the issue in forensics, is we're talking about latent fingerprints, right? And these are smudges at crime scene. And we don't know how much information we need to make a match based on a limited amount of data. And we also don't know how similar 2 fingerprints might appear to be as a result. So that's when you get into some of the troubles with reaching for weak evidence, and you can use a technique that might otherwise be reliable, but make it unreliable because there's really not enough information there.
Well, and so then now we might have multiple examiners right? So we don't know how one examiner is looking at that circumstance versus another. And maybe, you know, in bite marks, is that also the case?
Yeah, I think you're talking about, you know, inter-rater reliability or, right. You know, so when we don't know ground truth, in other words, we don't know we weren't there, we don't know what happened, who made the bite mark or what have you, is that the only way that you can really establish any kind of reliability is if you have experts with the same amount of experience and training and looking at the same data come to generally consistent, not identical conclusions, but consistent conclusions. You know, if you're looking at it, you know, one person says black and another person says white, you know, and they're both looking at the same evidence, it's hard to imagine, you know, that we know that they're not both right. And if we don't know if it actually is black or white, then we have a problem. And so this is true with many of the techniques that are explored in the book, is that you'll have experts, you know, that come into diametrically opposite opinions as to whether or not it's even a bite mark, right? Or whether or not these two hairs match. And then you have the same expert being inconsistent with themselves, right? They get, you know, a famous example in fingerprints is, you know, there was the bombing of the Madrid commuter train in Spain in 2004. I think 237 people died. It was a major international terrorism incident. And a man named Brandon Mayfield, who is a mild-mannered attorney in Portland, happened to be Muslim, happened to be married to an Egyptian national, and had happened to represent some people who had been convicted of providing material support for a terrorist organization. But he'd never been to Spain, and his fingerprints were matched to the blast caps, or a bag that the blast caps were found on, and it was not a lot of information in that particular latent fingerprint. The FBI matched him to that, and he was arrested on that, the strength of that match alone. Spent weeks held incommunicado in prison, and other experts were brought in because the Spanish authorities didn't believe that there was a good match. And two more experts concluded the same thing that the FBI experts had concluded, and that Brandon Mayfield was the source. The court hired an independent expert, and this independent expert likewise came to the same conclusion. And nobody could really, you know, doubt it at this point in Brandon Mayfield saying, that's not my latent fingerprint. You know, we have to, you know, I've never been to Spain. And the FBI held on to that opinion until the Spanish authorities matched it to somebody else that appeared to be a much better fit in terms of the profile. And this was really a shocking development because we talk about fingerprints and we tend to believe that they're accurate and reliable, and the FBI lab is one of the probably the most prestigious in the world. And this led to an effort on the FBI to remove some of the more biasing types of information that was used in this case. If you have a superior that is going to be checking your work like was done here, they concluded the same thing that the original examiners concluded, much more likely based on the fact that another examiner had made this match than the actual evidence at issue. And to really test that hypothesis, E.T.L. Joy is a very well-known cognitive neuroscientist and who's done all of the, you know, kind of the most significant studies in the influence of cognitive bias in forensics, did a test. And what he did is he took five very experienced latent fingerprint experts, people that have been decades of experience, board certified, everything. And he sent them fingerprint evidence, so a latent print from a crime scene and an exemplar of a potential match. But what he didn't say was that this was their own prior casework, that they had come to conclusions already on all of these different, you know, matches or non-matches. And the only thing that changed was the contextual information that was given to the fingerprint experts, right? So they pointed in one way or the other that, you know, that there was a confession or there's an eyewitness or something like that. And 67% changed their original opinion from the first time that they had done this analysis. And nothing changed about the fingerprints at all, just this irrelevant information that they had. And so we know, you know, that the influence of bias and a police or a prosecutor's theory can have on a subjective technique, right? No measurements are taken. So if you're just eyeballing evidence, you're saying, I think that these two things match, the influence of your relevant information is very, very powerful indeed.
So, I mean, you've said a couple things that are really, I think, interesting here. You know, I'm always kind of fascinated by the word forensic, for starters, right? Which just means it's being prepared for court, right?
Forensic, but
when you say you're a forensic odontologist, I mean, that sounds pretty impressive, right? What that means is you're a dentist who's going to court.
Right, right. Yeah, I had felt, you know, yes, this is what forensic dentists call themselves when they're in court. They call themselves forensic odontology, or forensic odontologists. And they invented a board called the American Board of Forensic Odontology, and that sounds very sciencey and obscure. And I think that you would listen to anybody who's calling themselves a board certified, you know, forensic odontologist, right? Even though it's entirely invented and there's no test to demonstrate that you can do what you claim to be able to do, but you can be board certified too. So this is an invented technique, and you could see how credentials, and I explore this in the book, when I trace kind of the origin of bite mark evidence kind of along with, you know, my client's wrongful convictions, is that they invented these credentials because there was no really established forensic area for dentists, right? But they were involved a little bit in forensics in the sense that many of us have heard about bodies being identified by their dental records, right? You've heard of, you know, somebody's like burned beyond recognition, can only be identified by their dental records. Most people aren't aware that that is your friendly neighborhood forensic dentist that works down at the medical examiner's office, moonlighting, you know, when he's not cleaning your teeth, he's down at the morgue identifying people by their dental records. This is a legitimate technique. It's basically valid, and although notable mistakes have been made there too, but they weren't in court. They weren't expert witnesses. They weren't the stars of these, you know, which were becoming more and more prominent. Forensic scientists was becoming a career in the 60s and the 70s that you could aspire to that hadn't been previously available. And so what they did is that they invented this board and they gained these credentials, and the use of identifying people was conflated with this idea of bite mark evidence, that they could be experts and make identifications not based on their teeth, but on the bite marks that teeth create. And again, if you're not thinking about it critically, that sounds like, yeah, opposite sides of the same coin, right? You know, and the line that I use in the book, you know, is that, you know, it's like a geologist claiming because they can identify a rock, that I can identify the rock that's used to bash in somebody's skull, right? Totally unrelated, but courts got hoodwinked, you know what I mean? And this kind of snuck into court, and it's still available today. If you're all 50 states, bite mark evidence is still admissible.
Well, so that's one of the more, I think, gripping. Unlike you, I wasn't an English major, I was a history major, but the same sort of fear of science pervaded my education. And so the history that you go through is really fascinating on how that happens, right? So if there's no scientific basis, don't we have a system to verify that, but when people come in and say that they're forensic odontologists, that we know what that is and that it's got a scientific basis?
You know, unlike toothpaste or aspirin or other consumer products in this country that have to be demonstrated to be safe for public consumption before they're used on public, used on the public or introduced in commercial settings, forensics have no such entity. There's nobody that's in charge of testing the scientific validity of any of the claims that are made in forensics. And the only thing standing between a junk science conviction and the use of junk science to gain that conviction is a judge. And if a judge allows it in, judges allows it in. That's the only gatekeeper as far as this goes. And, you know, many reasons contribute to why judges have failed to exclude that evidence. But, you know, one of the really central problems I think that you're alluding to, and this was true with me, is the widespread scientific illiteracy in this country, you know, generally, and lawyers, you know, in particular. You know, so yeah, like also, you know, I mean, and this is true with, you know, almost all law students, they're avoiding math. You know what I mean? But you can't do it anymore. You gotta eat your broccoli. And so that's part of the reason. And there are a number of other reasons, you know, is that, you know, and I think that one of the central tensions with using scientific evidence in criminal trials is that science is a process. Science is always moving forward. Science is abandoning previously held beliefs when they're demonstrated to be false. That's the opposite of law. Law is based on precedent. And precedent doesn't change very often, right? It's very static. And the judge, when he is deciding or she is deciding to introduce forensic science in a criminal trial, they're not contacting the scientists and deciding what they think. They're consulting case law. And case law, you know, once you get it into court,
is often, you know, just as scientifically illiterate as the lawyers who argued those cases, right? And you get, you know, bizarre opinions validating the most outrageously speculative techniques, and it's almost impossible to overturn that precedent. So as a result, you really end up with a tension that really can't be resolved in trials and in the adversarial system, because the adversarial system is a terrible place to work out the difference between nonsense and sense. And what you see is a twisting of logic and failure to, you know, actually do validation research or demonstrate the ability of the claimed abilities of these experts, right? Because, you know, this is another point that I make in the book, is that, you know, what is the incentive to do validation research if courts are already accepting the forensic technique as is, right? Most forensic techniques have no application outside of criminal trials, right? You don't need to get a, you know, a ballistics person in regular life, right? Who needs to know that, right? It's only useful in court. So if that's its only use and it's already being accepted, why risk doing some research that might undermine your claimed abilities or might undermine all the tens of thousands of convictions that rely on that same evidence? So what we really need is, and the Innocence Project has advocated for this for some time, is an entity like the FDA, you know, probably in something like NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, to do the validation research outside of the pressures of criminal trials. And, you know, there's really, it's astonishing to me that you could have, you know, life and liberty is at issue with the reliability of these techniques, and we really do nothing to, you know, police it at all.
So I think the conversation about the tension between the scientific process and the legal process is a really interesting one. And I've kind of always thought of it as, you know, that the board game you used to play when we were kids called Chutes and Ladders?
Yeah.
Right? I think of it as...
I don't remember the rules.
Well, it's very easy to explain. You're trying to go up board, you roll the dice. If you land on a ladder, you get to climb up diagonally across the board. If you hit a chute, it slides you back down, and whoever gets to the top of the board first wins, right? So I kind of think of the scientific process as the ladders, right? Science is always going a step better, getting better and better and growing and going forward. And the legal process, in its reliance on precedents, is the chute. Right? We don't want to be on the top step of the ladder with lawyers because we don't want that new science that gets out over our skis and makes us fall down. Mm-hmm. And so the tension there is the legal pressure is don't let it in until if it's too novel, right? Whereas science is always trying to get better and use that novelty because that's the in theory, the best stuff. Uh-huh. And the translation is then mangled by scientists who don't know the legal system and lawyers who don't know the scientific jargon. And here we are stuck in the middle.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's, and I think that I agree with what you just said, but and it's also the pressure of litigation and the adversarial process is that you have well-intentioned folks primarily, you know, like forensic analysts, they don't go into the business to frame innocent people. You know, most are interested in doing valid science. And what will happen often is that lawyers are very persuasive, prosecutors and defense attorneys, right? And so they get, you know, initial report that may be, and this happened in Stephen Cheney's case and some of the other cases that I explore in the book, is that you may get an opinion initially that doesn't really advance the ball much for you. You know, I mean, and this is your expert, and you'll work with that expert, right? And say, well, and we were talking today with Maria Cuellar, who's a statistician at Penn, and has been put under the similar types of pressure. Sometimes by me, you know, but not to say something that isn't true, but how are you going to actually say this, right? And so experts get pushed, and then sometimes it'll be very overt. Well, this person is a murderer, right? And we need a conclusive opinion, and consistent with the bite mark is not enough. That's not going to get it done, you know? I mean, and we know this person slaughtered two innocent people in their kitchen. And, you know, what we see is in Stephen Cheney's case, for example, two things happen. Is that one, the initial injury was supposed to have been the bite mark, the alleged bite mark, and there's a photograph in it, so I invite you to look at the photograph in the book and judge for yourself whether it looks like a bite mark to you. It doesn't to me. But it was initially judged to have been inflicted a couple of days before the actual homicide. And then when they actually identified Stephen Cheney as a suspect, it was only consistent with, you know, in other words, he couldn't be excluded from having made this mark. By the time we get to trial, the bite mark was inflicted at or near the time of death, and it was a one in a million chance that anybody other than Stephen Cheney would have inflicted that bite mark. So there you know, that's a, you know, paradigmatic example of exactly what we're talking about. And you see that again and again. And a lot of wrongful convictions is that, because wrongful convictions, usually the evidence is pretty weak. It's circumstantial. And that's when you start making those reaches for junk science, right? When you're trying to tie up loose ends and you're trying to get these opinions that can be swayed by lawyers being persuasive with their own experts.
Yeah, and I think the idea is that the adversarial system will fix that, right? Because you've got your expert that you're pushing in your direction, but I'm going to have my expert that I'm pushing in my direction, and shouldn't that solve the problem?
Yeah, you know, I mean, they call trials often, tell jurors that the trials are a search for the truth, right? And the and what we all know that the truth, you know, the search for the truth is not advanced through the use of junk science, let's say that, certainly. And, you know, the battle of the experts. And this is it makes me insane. I hate that term because it's usually a throwaway line that a judge will use when getting conflicting opinions about the same evidence. Well, we're going to admit both, and we're going to let the jury sort it out, right, through the adversarial system. And jurors are certainly no better than lawyers at separating good from bad science. And sometimes a battle of the experts is appropriate. You know, forensic accountants, you know, will disagree in the way, you know, a number should be, you know, moved one way or the other. And something like accident reconstruction, you could have a couple of different theories, you know, or something like that. But when you're talking about something like a bite mark, and we were talking about inter-rater reliability or that kind of thing, you shouldn't have a battle of the experts as to, like, whether or not it's even a bite mark to begin with, right? Or a fingerprint. You don't get like that in a fingerprint where people, I don't know, is it a fingerprint? I don't, you know, you say it is, I say it isn't. So a battle of the experts has been used as this kind of, you know, it's an abdication of responsibility to actually take a look at the validity of the opinions being proffered and just throwing it all in front of a jury, punting, essentially, and letting them sort it out.
Well, and I actually had a federal judge who had been a litigator for a long time say to me that when picking an expert, his rule was get one with a British accent because juries think British accents are smart.
This is true. I write about one of our British experts in the book, in the Eddie Lee Howard case.
So you've used British experts.
Yeah, and to great effect in Mississippi, right? They love those accents. You know, unlike me, you know, there's much more welcome in Mississippi than you know, a slick New York lawyer coming down there and telling what's what. I'm usually not very welcome. But yeah, I think that you know, these are the types of proxies that people use. I mean, it's funny because it's an accent, right? But, you know, the proxies that people use for, you know, what's a good scientist versus bad can be something as totally irrelevant as an accent.
Well, let me ask you one last question, and then we can open it up for questions from the audience. But, you know, we at the Quattrone Center, we kind of, to your point, that most forensic analysts don't wake up in the morning and think, you know, hooray, I get to go lie or do something inaccurate that's going to convict an innocent person. We kind of ask the question about where different roles in the system can be improved. And in a wrongful conviction, you've got the initial error, right, which is calling something a bite mark when it isn't or what have you. But then you've got all the checks and balances that have failed. So the prosecutor, the police have accepted that as a useful investigative tool. The prosecutor has accepted it as a useful tool for proving guilt or innocence. The public defender, the defender of the case, has been unable to rebut that or prevent it from coming in. The judge has allowed it in, and the jury, you know, is not well informed. How do we really make that change in the American criminal justice system, right? We've got the federal system where the FBI lab is, which is supposedly the hallmark of all of this, is only about 10% of criminal cases and not a lot of the really violent felonies. And then you've got, you know, an elected DA, maybe you've got elected judges, but I mean, who should we really go to try to put a stick in the spokes of that process that you articulate so well in the book?
Well, you know, as I was talking about before, you know, I think we need something like the FDA to do the validation research, you know, and remove it from the legal system entirely. And I think that what's also scary. So I don't have an answer other than that. But what's scary to me, because it's becoming a more and more of a pernicious problem, is that in addition to traditional forensic techniques that are in your traditional crime labs, you know, which are part of the law enforcement apparatus, right? They're not separated from law enforcement. Nor the National Academy of Sciences said in 2009 that we have to separate these entities, right? Because they're not an extension of law enforcement. Science is science, right? It's not about catching bad guys. And so when you're doing that type of science, you can't have the mindset that I'm here to, you know, solve crimes. I'm here to do science. That's got to be the mindset. But what we're seeing more and more with emerging technology and things like facial recognition and ShotSpotter and some of the other surveillance techniques is that we're having private companies, private corporations that are moving into the criminal justice system, and they're there to make money, not necessarily to advance justice. You know, that's the goal, is to make money. And what we have increasingly is not so much an expert witness pointing the finger, but we have a black box pointing the finger at suspects. And that's really, really problematic because for a number of reasons. One is that the folks that are selling this technology are motivated to hype the technology beyond, they're salespeople, right? They're hyping the technology in a way that they want to make a sale, right? And they're huge sales because these are municipalities that are buying this technology. And then you have the politicians or the police departments or the district attorney's offices that have purchased this technology for millions of dollars and are incentivized to tout how effective this is at crime control and how whiz-bang the technology is being used. And in court, where defense attorneys have sought to challenge this evidence using their Sixth Amendment rights to challenge or to confront witnesses against them, courts have, astonishingly, this is a, you know, I'm pretty cynical, as you probably already gathered, but astonishingly have elevated trade secrets above fundamental right to confront witnesses and have not given access to the defense to have their own experts analyze the black box technology that's being used against their clients. And, you know, to demonstrate, you know, if I may, a quick example as to just how devastating that can be, is that the OCME in New York used what was called the FST, the Forensic Statistical Tool, to analyze very tiny amounts of DNA sample mixtures, right? So now DNA technology often has 3, 4, 5 different contributors because it's so sensitive. And they had insisted for years that it was validated internally and that it was, you know, there was nothing to see here and it was great stuff. And they would refuse, citing that proprietary technology. And this is a publicly funded crime lab. I was like, well, that's my money. I'm a New York City taxpayer. What, you know, so that's my black box. I want to see it. But that never happened. Finally, it gets to federal court, and a federal defender named Chris Flood challenged it. And a federal judge who doesn't see this kind of argument every day and was astonished by it, you know, saying, well, we can do a protective order if you insist, but I'm going to allow the defense to take a look at the algorithm. And when they did, they discovered a flaw that implicated thousands of cases and led to at least one being overturned and the abandonment of this tool that had been used for a decade in New York and would have been discovered much sooner had, you know, judges been, you know, willing to vindicate defendants' Sixth Amendment rights. And so that tension is moving into criminal courts right now today, and it's very, very scary.
Well, and I think, you know, one of the more haunting parts of that kind of a story, which, A, the increase of technology and what that might mean for our ability to do that kind of test, but also I think a big reason for the pushback on a lot of the things that you're doing is this fear that if you're right, which you seem to be most of the time, that a lot of cases, like thousands, tens of thousands of cases that we thought were built on this unimpeachable scientific foundation are going to be revealed to really be on very shaky footing. And I think that's a really haunting image and thing to worry about. When you start worrying about fingerprints not having really the scientific foundational basis that we thought they had, you know, that doesn't mean that everybody who's been convicted on the basis of fingerprints is innocent, but it does mean that we might have to take a really hard look at a huge number of cases out there, and we really don't know our own error rate in these cases.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and, you know, I talk a lot about, you know, the so-called principle of finality in the criminal justice system, and this is essentially what it means is that once a jury has come back guilty, you really don't have any more recourse, right? You get maybe one appeal, and that's it, you know, and the discovery of forensic DNA and the establishment of the Innocence Project really disrupted the status quo in that way and challenged the finality principle because juror verdicts were thought to be basically almost always reliable. And when you're questioning techniques that have been used for a century, like microscopic hair comparison, which is something I spent some time talking about in the book, in 2012, the FBI finally admitted, after using this technique for 60, 70 years, that the experts that have been testifying in trials in state criminal court trials across the country had been systematically grossly exaggerating and the probative value of those matches, had made misleading statements again and again and again and again. And when that audit finally happened, 70 people had already been wrongfully convicted, at least in part, due to the use of microscopic hair comparison. And nothing was being done until media pressure was brought to bear because of how disruptive it was. It was a huge story, right? It made international headlines, and we had to go back with the FBI and the NACDL, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and the Innocence Project collaborated on an audit of thousands and thousands of cases. It was my first week at the Innocence Project. It was mind-blowing. But yeah, there's a strong, strong incentive not to question prior convictions.
So this is the part where we'll turn it over to you, and we'll ask, you know, to take your questions. Happy to hear what you would like to know about. There are some microphones coming down, so raise your hand. We'll get you a microphone, and then you can make sure that we're recording your question for the podcast.
Hi. Quick question. The study with the fingerprints that was 67, about 70% inaccurate, did they ever go back and review those cases, or did they just say, ha-ha, we messed up and left it?
It was the latter, right? As far as I know, they wouldn't go back and review the cases. What that Brandon Mayfield case did was the FBI at least started doing something called linear sequential unmasking, which is, or really linear ASV. And what that means is that when they look at the latent fingerprint and they decide what's of value in that print before they look at the exemplar, right? And so if you look at them together, our minds want to create patterns. They want to see matches. And what you'll have often, if you don't do one at a time and you're looking at them together, we tend to see matches. So that was one thing. And they also stopped having superiors or check other people's work, and that where you knew the conclusion that the first examiner had come to before the verifier does an independent exam. So the FBI, to their credit, did do some work to, at least on a going forward basis, try to eliminate some of the more obvious biases. But no, they haven't gone back and looked at prior casework.
Thank you so much. I have a quick question. So as you said earlier, once guilty is served, is it an easy process to have it overturned, or is it a very difficult process to overturn it?
So it's a cake, right?
Yeah. I'm not sure there's anything more difficult than overturning a criminal verdict after some time. You know, one of the reasons that I included Stephen Cheney's case was, you know, demonstrating how much evidence of innocence there was and how hard of a struggle it was for him to finally, you know, be released, because, you know, there was testing before that meeting that I read about. And the reason that the line may have not landed the same way that I hope it will land if you read the book is that he had years before DNA testing done under one of the victim's fingernails that had excluded him as a potential perpetrator. But that wasn't enough for an exoneration. And so he thought, you know, years before we met, and he had a lawyer, they'd done this DNA testing, that he was going to be released because he knew he was innocent and they would get a new trial, and that didn't happen. So what I used the case to do is to explore all the different reforms, some that have been successful, some that haven't, that had to go in to work to overturn that conviction. And that includes the 2009 National Academy of Sciences report. It includes the establishment of the Texas Forensic Science Commission that does independent investigations of forensics in that state. It includes the creation of what I referenced in the reading, the junk science writ, which allows prisoners who've been convicted on suspect evidence to go back into court if they can demonstrate that the science has been discredited by the process of time or process of science. And the Conviction Integrity Unit, which John spends a lot of time working with at the Quattrone Center, that they agreed. We went in there, and I write this scene in the book, one, to persuade on innocence, but also to persuade the prosecutors that Stephen Cheney had been convicted on junk science. And so all of that had to happen. And the Texas High Court had to sign off on the case before he was allowed to leave prison after all those years. So it's really one of the most hard, you know, difficult things to do in the law, and it's one of the reasons why it's so important to get it right the first time.
And in a lot of jurisdictions, even once you've gotten the prosecutors to agree with you, they don't have the power to retract. They can't simply say, hey, we got it wrong, and the courts say, oh, well, then we're done here, right? There has to be, the court has the power to do it, but then they require certain legal proceedings to happen. So it's not, you can't even just get the agreement of both parties in the litigation to say, yeah, we all agree this was a mistake. Then you have to go convince the courts.
And how hard that is to get that agreement. You know, we've had clients that were freed, came to the Innocence Network conference, right? You know, I mean, and then had their convictions, the conviction being overturned, getting overturned again on appeal and having to go back to prison after being released, which I just can't even imagine anything more devastating than that.
Chris, you talked about the battle of the experts and the deficiencies in those battles. But to what extent is this a resource issue? I mean, in how many cases is there no competing expert? Because I'm assuming a public defender or a court-appointed lawyer can't go hire an expert without getting the court to approve payment for that that expert's fees. So how many of these cases are cases where there's just no competing evidence, expert evidence?
It's a great point. Resources certainly play a role. You know, what we've seen in many, many wrongful conviction cases, including Stephen Chaney's case, is that we had experts, that he had an expert that, well, his expert actually ended up kind of agreeing with the prosecution expert. So, you know, you're constitutionally entitled to funds for expert witness testimony, or expert witnesses in cases, so that's a little bit less of an issue than it was previously. But, you know, what I really think another reason why I think it's so important to get it right before it gets involved in a criminal case is that, you know, anytime a defendant is in the dock, has been indicted, is standing trial, he's got two strikes against him, right? You know, everybody in the courtroom except for, you know, the client and the defense attorney believe that this person is likely to have done something, that they didn't pick his name out of a phone book. So the biases against, you know, an acquittal are very, very strong. So while it's important to have, you know, good lawyering and expert witnesses on both sides, or at least for the defense to combat something like an unreliable opinion, I don't think it's enough that you could fully fund, you know, all, you know, get a Cadillac defense on that for the public defender side, and you would still end up with a lot of wrongful convictions because for all the biases that I talked about, but also because the some of these techniques should never be introduced to begin with. And you really can't cross-examine your way out of a junk science conviction or have another expert say, that's actually all junk, right? You know what I mean? So you would have bite mark evidence being used and experts disagreeing, but really who cares? It should never have been in to begin with. So many of these techniques, and we're seeing a little bit of progress here, in particularly in federal court, where they've been reining in some of these really, you know, extravagant claims that are being made by expert witnesses around the country, like in firearms and tool mark cases, where they'll claim that, you know, that bullet was fired by that gun to exclusion of every other gun in the history of time ever manufactured, right? It's only that bullet. So you're getting a little bit more of a willingness to say, you know what, that's too far, you know, I mean, and you can only do, you know, that gun cannot be excluded as a potential source of, you know, or having fired that bullet. And, you know, what I want to point out to, you know, folks who disagree with me, and certainly there are many who do, that this hasn't caused the sky to collapse, right? The criminal justice system hasn't fallen apart. In those cases, convictions were still obtained, right, because of, you know, they went into court, they said, they showed the way that the stria matched, you know, this particular bullets, and, you know, juries convicted, because jurors believe in forensics. So, and those convictions, as a result, are much more reliable and much more stable in the long run than one where you go into court and make this extravagant claim that really, you know, there's no statistical foundation to make that type of claim. You don't even make it in DNA. But they're being made every day in court right now today, and we know that, you know, there's really no way to that the research will ever catch up with a claim like that. It's just not possible.
Thank you so much. Would you talk about what goes on in the jury room and some of the influences, and specifically have television shows and the media had any influence?
That's a great question. So how many of you watch Forensic Files or CSI, right? It's fiction, right? I mean, and so is Forensic Files, even though it's docuseries, right? I'll tell you, Alfred Swinton's a client of mine who passed away last year, sadly. The lawyers in my department watch those shows, the ones, the docuseries. And not so much for the entertainment value, but sometimes to pick up clients. We watched that show, and Alfred Swinton was depicted as a serial killer that had, you know, they're trying to put 8 bodies on him, right? And he was only convicted on 1 murder, and it was based on bite mark evidence. And so we picked up his case, and he was exonerated maybe 18 months later. And you could still, for the next 5 years, watch it on YouTube as him being convicted as a convicted murderer. I wrote to Bill Curtis, the host, right? The guy who was on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, right? I was just like, Bill, he's been exonerated. Can we get this thing taken down? He never got back to me. But the broader point really is that those shows depict forensics as infallible. And a lot of lay jurors and people who go into court believe that forensic evidence is really essentially infallible, and we know it's not. There's a bite mark episode in CSI and show match, right? And there's like, that's the guy. So you could watch it today, go look it up. It's a known phenomenon called the CSI effect in criminal law. But there's two sides there are two different ways to look at the CSI effect. And so from the defense perspective, it's exactly what we've just been talking about, right? Jurors are given this false impression of infallible forensics. Prosecutors say that the CSI effect is that jurors expect scientific evidence in every case, right? That it's in everything. And so they're compelled to, you know, continue using unreliable evidence because jurors expect some sort of science. So, yeah, media is one of the themes I explore in the book, but both in terms of hyping forensics, but also leading to wrongful convictions, right? So the cases that are discussed and explored in the book are usually very high-profile, very sensational crimes, and that type of media hype will lead to a lot of pressure for arrests and pressure on expert witnesses and pressure on prosecutors, and can lead to a lot of miscarriages of justice. And then the opposite is true, you know, on when you're heading toward an exoneration and you get a media stories behind it, can put pressure, the same pressure, to undo a wrongful conviction. So none of which should matter, right? You know, it should matter what's happening in court, but it does.
How much responsibility do you think is on lawyers and the legal profession? So you hear DNA experts, I've heard some say they're not supposed to say this is a match, they're supposed to say we can't exclude, but then you'll have attorneys say it's a perfect match. And so you also mentioned lawyers don't like science. And so how much, like, you know, I don't think there's a junk science course offered for us in law school. So how much do you think is on like lawyers and the legal profession to be educating us?
Yeah, lawyers have a responsibility here, you know what I mean, is that we really can't avoid science any longer. You know what I mean, what we have often is lawyers will attempt to discharge this duty by consulting with an expert witness, right? I gave the discovery to the expert told me what to say, told me how to do the cross, and that's what I did. And you have to have, you know, some basic scientific understanding to even have an intelligent conversation with an expert witness. And you have to have some, you know, one of the things like that, you know, we were talking about at lunch today is that if there had been statisticians around at the birth of some of these pattern matching techniques, right, then so much of this would have been avoided, right? And say, you know what, you can't say that, because you don't have a valid statistical foundation to make these probabilistic claims, or certainly not individualization claims, you know, and they could have been like, you know, that's really just total speculation, you can't do that. And there weren't. So having basic scientific literacy, it doesn't mean that we're all going to be mathematicians, but you can't avoid science. You know, I mean, and lawyers, they all get through law school, they all have great reading comprehension, and if you can read a textbook, you can certainly read a scientific report. It's boring, yes, I grant you, but You got to do it. Got to eat your broccoli.
Yeah, and so you could take my conviction integrity class in law school and maybe get some of that or something from the Professor Epstein teaches at Temple, I'm sure, is a similar analog. But I think Chris is right, right? The obligation of lawyers and judges, and for that matter, of all of us, is to be educated consumers and critical thinkers of the material. And to that end, I want to thank the library for having us, letting us have this talk to share the really important stuff that Chris is writing about. And I think libraries are wonderful for that, and we're grateful for the chance to be here with all of you and for your presence. So please join me in thanking Chris Fabricant.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.